This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This is not a local problem. You know, this is a national problem. 30% of the nation's total oil and gas supply comes through this coast.
With so much focus on the BP oil spill and the havoc it has wrought on the Gulf Coast, it's easy to overlook the broader, more long-term environmental dilemma that serves as the backdrop for that catastrophe. Louisiana's coastline is shrinking at an alarming rate. This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Bob Marshall of the New Orleans-based The Lens. In conjunction with ProPublica, The Lens recently published Marshall's in-depth piece on Louisiana's imperiled shores. In the first part of our two-part discussion, Marshall recounts the history of the region's struggle to keep dry and delves into the reasons why human efforts to harness Mother Nature so often have gone awry. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Pulitzer Prize-winning environmental journalist Bob Marshall. He works for The Lens as an environmental journalist. Bob, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why don't you first explain the battle that has been underway for decades and where we are right now in terms of the disappearing coastline of Louisiana?
Well, you know, most people became aware of our coast probably during the BP oil spill, which is coming up on 5 years ago.
Right.
And talking with other journalists who came here, especially foreign journalists, they were said, well, how big is this? And my response was always that it was terrible. It was a tragedy. It never should have happened. But really, this is a temporary problem on a permanent disaster. And that permanent disaster is the fact that Louisiana's coast, especially the southeastern section, which is around New Orleans, has been disappearing at the rate of 50 to 16 square miles a year. And because of subsidence and sea level rise, most of this entire area, including all those wetlands they were concerned about during the oil spill, will be part of the Gulf of Mexico in about 50 to 70 years if nothing is done.
And I don't know if you've read this book, but I read Rising Tide by John Barry, just a terrific history of the events, both human and natural, that led up to the handling of the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. That was written almost 20 years ago now. It didn't take into account a lot of the modern elements that have affected the coastline. First, though, why don't you give us kind of a recap of the history of handling the Mississippi River. If you can take a step back to the struggle and the conflict to decide whether to go with levees or canals, and the role of the Army Corps of Engineers is fascinating.
Well, yeah, I know John well, and that is a great book. First, you have to understand that all of southern Louisiana, everything below, say, I-10, if you're looking at the state like as the outline of a boot, everything on the foot section of that boot, it was built by the Mississippi River. This is all part of the delta of the Mississippi River, built over about 7,000 years since the last ice age. And deltas are built primarily when a river overflows its banks and deposits a sediment in these flat areas. And over thousands of years, as much as 400 feet of sediment from the first hard rock below us to the surface of the Gulf of Mexico was deposited, not just by the main stem of the river, but by all the distributaries that branch off the river here on the coastal plain. And so the river was, this was the Amazon of North America, 6,000 square miles of wetlands when the Europeans first showed up and the French established New Orleans in 1718. And they did that for a good reason, because by putting New Orleans there and a couple of forts, they controlled access to about two-thirds of the continent, because the Mississippi River drainage, right, drains everything between the Appalachians and the Rockies all the way up into Canada. And that was the only way to travel up and down the continent at that time in 1718. So the city grew and immediately had a problem because in the spring, this huge river, the fourth largest in the world, would come over its banks and flood things. So they began putting up levees. And they realized what a gold mine this was and how politically powerful it was. So the city grew and so did plantations up and down the river, and that meant more levees. Well, these levees kept getting blown out by this huge river until about 1927, something called the Great Flood of 1927, which flooded everything from southern Illinois to New Orleans, made 750,000 people homeless, and Congress said, Corps of Engineers, never let this happen again. And that's when the Corps spent years building the Mississippi River levee system, the biggest, strongest levee system in the world, and it sure did its job. It protected the industries and homes and communities along the river. But it also blocked that annual overflowing that the river, the delta, needs to maintain itself, because all this hundreds of feet of sediment is pressing down by gravity on that first hard rock. So it's going to begin to subside as soon as the river stops giving it new sediment.
And we can also take the Nile River delta shift. And when man injects itself into these very big forces of nature, consequences aren't always what man had planned for in the beginning, right?
Well, no, it never is. Of course, no one in the 1700s knew, you know, they didn't think this was anything wrong or bad because they didn't have the science to guide them. But all the major deltas in the world are in similar trouble for the same reasons. They were developed, obviously, as the smart place to build a community because of trade, and you needed the rivers for trade into continents and around the world. So all the major deltas are in trouble because of development. Someone once asked me, what's the best way to build on a delta? Well, you shouldn't, but if you did, you'd put everything on stilts so the river could flow under you and continue to maintain that delta. So in 1927, the Corps got its orders, and by 1933, had finished this levee system and shut off the river from its delta and began starving this delta. That was an eventual death sentence, really, for all of South Louisiana. But if that's all we had done, according to researchers with the government and with LSU, Louisiana State University, and other places, if that's all we had done was put these levees up, the wetlands that were intact in 1933 would still be largely intact today. But that's not all we did, because about the same time we finished those levees, 1930-31, oil was discovered in the coastal zone. And there were no protections for wetlands then. Wetlands were considered worthless, right? They grew mosquitoes, which caused yellow fever, and very few people lived there. And most of this area was privately owned. 80% of the coast was privately owned. So oil companies came in and offered, in many cases, you know, these Cajun trappers and fishermen about not much per acre for their mineral rights, and sure enough, they discovered oil and gas. Eventually, 50,000 permits were given for oil and gas in a coastal zone, and the only way to get to the spots that they wanted to drill, was just to dredge up this marsh. And eventually, more than 10,000 miles of canals were dredged for oil and gas pipelines, another 550 for shipping. The canals for oil and gas were 100 to 125 feet wide and 10 to 15 feet deep. And of course, that removed about 11% of the total surface area, and that let salt water into the heart of these estuaries and began killing plants. And without the plants to hold the soil together, this disaster that should have taken hundreds of years was compressed into 70 years, a single human lifetime. Now, by 1990, or today anyway, we've lost about 2,000 square miles of these wetlands. And the Gulf of Mexico, that used to be a long drive from New Orleans, is now pushing up against the back door of these suburbs.
So the dredging was like the first real cause and effect that we could point to and see that there was a change.
Well, if the levees were not on the river, the river would still be building a delta, even with this dredging. Mm-hmm. But when it was being starved, first we starved of the sediment, and then we eviscerated its circulatory system with all these canals. And there's also research showing that in the areas where there was the most intensive oil and gas extraction, we had the highest rates of subsidence. So what your listeners need to know is that the other problem we have Of course, then we discovered oil and gas offshore in the 1940s and figured out how to drill out there. And so we have 4,000 rigs off our coast, the largest concentration of oil and gas structures anywhere on the planet. This whole oil and gas infrastructure is connected to the coast by pipelines. And we've got 50,000 miles of pipelines running across the state. 50% of the nation's refining capacity is along this coast. And it's taking much of that oil and gas to other places in the country. And so all this infrastructure is there and exposed. When we lost these wetlands, the marshes and the swamps, hurricane researchers consider them linear levees because they spread out storm surge and can slow it down. So we don't have that protection. And they were also the engine that drives what is still the most productive coastal estuary in the continent south of Alaska. But the problem is that these wetlands, these marshes, are that engine, that platform for this whole system. And we've lost, in southeast Louisiana around New Orleans, we've lost more than half of what we had, and we continue to lose it at the rate of 16 square miles a year because not only are we sinking, but now the sea is rising due to global warming. And so to give your listeners an idea, NOAA and the National Climate Assessment figures most of the country might see around 3 to 3.5 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. In our area and around New Orleans, they're looking at 4.5 to 5.5 feet because we're sinking at the same time the Gulf is rising. And so that's what we're facing. And that's really the big story here. The oil was awful, and it shouldn't have happened, but it really was like someone with cancer getting the flu. You know, they're going to get over the flu, but they still have got cancer. And that's the real issue here, because this entire area, all the areas in southeast Louisiana outside current hurricane protection levees, will be underwater by the end of the century if this problem isn't addressed and fixed.
Job in the great north woods, working as a cook for a spell, but I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a employed, working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind, and I just grew
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmental journalist Bob Marshall. 40 years ago, Bob Dylan released Blood on the Tracks with the song Tangled Up in Blue, which sings about Delacroix, mentions Delacroix, Louisiana, which was a town of 700 people back then. Now it's around 15. How is Delacroix a microcosm for what's happening in Louisiana's coastal region?
I did a series on Delacroix just for that purpose, using it as an example of what's happened to so many of these coastal communities and cultures. Delacroix is only 25 miles from the French Quarter, but it was isolated, really, from the city by these wetlands. And the wetlands not only gave it a cultural isolation, but also basically supported what was a subsistence lifestyle for the people who lived there. They were trappers and commercial fishermen. And years ago, moss pickers, believe it or not, they would pick moss for the furniture companies that would use Spanish moss to stuff mattresses and sofas and things. They had a complete subsistence lifestyle. They lived along the what we call the banks of one of the bayous that came off the river, Bayou Terre Boeuf Sauvage. It was named that by the French because when they went down this river at the time, this bayou, there were bison, wild cattle, as they called them. That's how high the ground was at that time. And so these folks lived a pretty isolated and contented life. They came into the city maybe once every couple of years to buy things they couldn't buy or that the grocery boats couldn't bring to them, furniture, things like that. And their life was going along pretty steadily until these wetlands began falling apart. There was kind of that happened, began for them to really notice this was in the 50s, and that was about the same time hard surface roads were extended down there, so people could, all weather roads, so they could get back and forth. But the trappers and the fishermen began noticing that, you know, the places they set their traps were, they used to be wrist deep, were now elbow deep, and some of the islands that they used to fish around, the marsh islands, were shrinking and then just becoming open water. Those wetlands protected them, gave them some protection from storms. It was really hit hard by Hurricane Betsy in 65, unlike any other storms, and there had been big storms before. And that was about the time they began saying, wait a minute, these canals are a big problem. They're letting water, salt water, into here. The tides are coming up higher, and the storms are flooding us much worse than ever. And then, of course, after Betsy, about 80% of that population moved back down. And then Katrina hit, really wiped them out, because there was even between 65 and 2005, you know, they lost probably half of the wetlands. You know, their homes were just wiped away. When I flew the area after Katrina, it was, you know, I used to call it, it was gone. I think that was a lead on my stories. And so today, 14 families live there full time. The rest of it has been kind of rebuilt by sport fishermen who, you know, that's not their livelihood. It's their camp, and they drive down there to enjoy fishing and hunting in what's left of that marsh. And really, it's kind of a microcosm. These folks, by the way, grew up speaking Spanish because they were actually descendants of settlers that the Spanish king sent here in the 1780s.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, so when I went down there the first time as a kid fishing with my next-door neighbor's grandfather, I thought, you know, I said, God, what are all the Mexicans doing here? Because I heard Spanish, and the only people I knew who spoke Spanish were Mexicans, right? In fact, Spanish scholars go down there to study because just some of the old folks still speak the language. And so, you know, these cultures were really unique and subsistence lifestyles. And as these wetlands began eroding and falling apart, and also as the oil and gas industry moved in to offer different types of jobs, these cultures have been largely lost.
But some of these townships that weren't waterfront property are now becoming,
yes,
linked more and more closely to the Gulf, whether it's in their history or not, correct?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, the fishing villages of the novels and some of the old movies, those are gone. People say, I want to see a Cajun fishing village. Well, you know, the internet's around. I mean, people have been weaned off the wetlands by the pipeline in many cases. They might still shrimp on their days off, but the rest of the time they work somewhere in the oil and gas industry. So basically, some of these communities that used to be protected by several miles of marsh and swamps or both are now looking at open water in some cases. There are highways you can drive down here, Louisiana Highway 1 through Lafourche Parish, or down in Terrebonne Parish south of Houma to Montague and Chauvin and Cocodrie, where, you know, 30 years ago when you drove those roads, there were blankets of marsh and or swamp on either side. And now you can see the water. There's just fringes of marsh. And in some cases, those roads will flood just on high tides with the south wind. So it's changed dramatically.
Your river roars all day and the river roars all night. Some people got lost in the flood and some people got away all right. And the river have busted so clear down to black and white.
the lower ninth. Louisiana, Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away, they're trying to wash us away. Louisiana, Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away, they're trying to wash us away. Now President Coolidge come down here in a railroad train.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Bob Marshall. Why don't you give us an idea, as somebody who's covered this area for several decades, what it's like driving from New Orleans out to the outer banks of the Delta now compared to several decades ago?
Well, I grew up here hunting and fishing and still do that, and paddling and exploring out in the Delta. Had a fishing hunting camp out 30 miles or 30 minutes by boat from anywhere. And what we were seeing, you know, most of the people here live inside the levees and they don't go on the other side of these mud walls. The only time they see the wetlands is when they drive maybe the Baton Rouge and cross on these elevated interstates through some of the swamps, or perhaps they might drive down to Grand Isle, about 70 miles south of New Orleans, and that route takes them out across Louisiana Highway 1, which was built across the marsh to Grand Isle, about a 15-mile stretch in which they basically dredged a canal, a borrow canal, and piled up mud to put the road on. And by the way, that road floods on a regular basis now.
Trying to place the blame and trying to get some of the deeper pocketed oil and gas interests to help pay for restoring this is one of the potential solutions. Why don't you kind of give us an overview of Louisiana's way out of this predicament?
Well, the second part of that series with ProPublica, we called it Louisiana's Moonshot, because Louisiana has developed what's known as the Master Plan for the Coast. It's a 50-year, $50 billion plan that if it works the way the computers say it could work, if it's implemented on time and the projects work the way they're supposed to work, then it could preserve some of what's left. It can't bring back what's lost, most of it, 2,000 square miles. It could protect some of what's left and rebuild some of what was lost so that it would have enough wetlands for a functioning ecosystem and also provide some storm surge protection. The way to do that would be to put the river back to work in these wetlands by moving the sediment and fresh water from the river back into these sinking basins. They'll do that two ways. Well, half of that $50 billion is for structural storm surge protection for communities, and the rest of it would be used for either dredging and pumping the sediment from the river into these marshes to rebuild them, or building what they call sediment diversions. It's kind of like, flood walls or dams in the levee at different places. And when the river comes up, they would open the floodgates and let this river carry sediment back into these sinking basins. That's the grand plan. But the state doesn't have $50 billion. It was hoping to get money from Congress. Right after Hurricane Katrina, when Democrats had Congress, they did authorize 15 projects for the coast with an estimated, the authorization was for about $1.55 billion. But in the 7 years since then, when things have changed in Washington and they haven't allocated a penny for any of those projects, the state has been able to find some money of its own. When the times were good, they put about $400,000 into this. They also have some money coming from other ongoing authorizations, and they're also have gotten about $1 billion so far from BP fines, and it's all dedicated to this this coastal plan. But you know, the big problem is even if they realize, even if they get like the maximum benefit from the fines against BP, They'll probably be running out of money in about 10 years. And so when that happens, they'll either have to pull projects off the board, which means those wetlands won't be rebuilt. Those swamps and marshes will just stay open water.
And this is a plan that's trying to, as you say, balance the equation by 2060, just to give us an idea of the timeline, right?
Right, and by 2060. And once again, it's people say, why didn't they go for more? Well, they knew getting $50 billion would be hard enough. And this is not a local problem. You know, this is a national problem. 30% of the nation's total oil and gas supply comes through this coast. You know, when Katrina shut down our coast, the price of gas rose 46 cents a gallon over a weekend. It also has the largest port in the nation. The port of South Louisiana, which is Baton Rouge to New Orleans, connects to 31 states. And when that port has to close during storms now, it costs the country about $310 million a day. And so 50% of the refining capacity is here. All these pipelines, all these oil and gas structures, all of that is at risk. So the states, where are we going to get the money? Because Congress doesn't look like it wants to spend any money. And the oil and gas industry, they were hoping it would step up to the table out of, if nothing else, self-interest. But they're not interested in doing that.
What would be their self-interest here?
Well, they have all the oil and gas refineries, all the onshore support facilities for the offshore oil and gas work, all the pipelines that they're responsible for, that many of which were buried beneath the marsh and now are becoming exposed to open water and the buffeting of waves and wind. That's an amazingly, it's something like $20 billion.
So preserving their investment in this region.
Yes, exactly. The roads that they use to get to their facilities on land are going underwater as this whole area is, you know, because of the levees and the canals that they dredged, the impact of those things, and because of the oil and gas they extracted, all these things now are vulnerable to being destroyed. God, that would be probably make the BP disaster look like a walk in the park. So then the oil and gas industry is very powerful in Louisiana. It used to be, in the 80s, I think it was responsible for something like 40% of the state's income. It's now down to about 14%. But it's been very powerful politically, and so our congressional delegation, as well as the state legislature, fights any types of regulations. For example, our congressional delegation, with the exception of the lone Democrat from New Orleans, fight carbon regulation. In fact, during the BP disaster, when the Obama administration did try to push through some reform of oil and gas drilling regulations, our delegation fought it. So it's kind of a suicide path for this people of the state. You know, they keep sending these people back to Washington and Baton Rouge, and they in turn take steps that basically ensure or are going to help ensure that this area won't even be here by the end of the century.
Be sure to tune in next week to See Change Radio for the second part of my discussion with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Bob Marshall.
Sway the future to the past, find what will endure.
You've been listening to See Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Clifton Chenier, Bob Dylan, and Martin Simpson. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to See Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For See Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.